So if you go like animal filing, you got it. So, glad to be on your team.
Appreciate it.
Mr. Scott.
Jeff Scott, Rock Island County Commission.
Don Leonard, I'm with the Burlington Industry. I'm the aquaculture representative to the council.
Leland Myers, I represent the publicly owned Treatment Works. That'd be you, Dan. You're next.
And this is in their area, just so you know. So watch what you're doing.
So if you crap, it's coming to me.
There you go. Pretty much it. I'm Dan Tuttle, representing Tukwila County.
Julie Peck Dadlin, representing Salt Lake County.
Chris Von Huey, I'm the alternate conservation.
Let's go around the room, starting over here, Laura.
Laura Brennan, Fortune Garden Statements.
Wayne Martinson, National Audubon Society.
Erica Gaddis, Division of Water Quality.
Linda Freitas, Friends of Great Salt Lake.
Tom Tripp, U.S. Magnesium.
I'm Brian Matthew, I work for the Tribune, Salt Lake Tribune.
Dave Slifka, I'm with Morton Salt.
I'm Ryan Willeitner with CH2M Hill.
Bill Pope with HDR.
Jill Houston with Central Davis Sewer.
Laura Ault, Fourth Street Fire and State Lines.
Joe Havasey, Compass Minerals, Ogden.
Jody Gardner with Water Quality. Sorry, I'm behind you.
Yeah, it's okay.
I'll do your leg.
We have several items on the agenda. Some won't take very long. We wanted to get everyone an update on the integrated water resource model development, where that stands. The Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands, through the Division of Purchasing, issued requests for proposals. Those came in. The selection committee, there were five proposals. The selection committee has met and reviewed all of those, provided input to the Division of Purchasing for finalization of the procurement. Laura, could you explain the phases in the report, in the process?
Sure. So we're under strict gag order to not say anything about the proposal process now, but what we can say is when the project kicks off, it'll be kind of a two-phase project where the first phase is information gathering and gathering existing data and then getting together with stakeholders to figure out what exactly the model can do and what the final piece, what the model will produce for us. So that's kind of the first phase, and the second phase will be the creation of the model.
And then, you know, this is one of our highest priorities. The reason for that is that it addresses a lot of issues when we look at the water resource coming in. It addresses issues associated with lake level. It allows us to address impacts on lake level from additional either development upstream or in lake uses. It allows us to look at the issues relating to for pollution control. The issues related to It allows us to look at the issues relating to influx of pollutant load based on mass loading and understanding of the concentrations. So. Pretty important component. It's going to help us ultimately with the review of the Bear River project that we talked about at the last meeting. So very important to us. We want to invite to make sure everyone has an opportunity to be involved if they wish during the phase one, which is the setup for getting the model completed. And then the phase two will be the generation of the model. It's probably going to be about an 18-month, two-year project. We think that the selection will be announced shortly.
Any minute.
So we think that's happening shortly. And we think it's an important first step.
Tom?
That's a two-year contract?
Will be a two-year contract.
Yeah. And both years are fully funded?
Mm-hmm.
And if you were to look at our matrix, you'll find that it was one of our highest priorities. So we're going to go up with that a little bit later. We had a request from Wayne Martinson, who's with the National Audubon. A report was provided in the email that went out to everyone that they have produced. Wayne asked for a few minutes today to address the issues contained in that report. So Wayne, you're up.
Great.
I think where I'm seated will work just fine. So there's not quite enough of the first great satellite level matrix, so if you can share that. But there's enough of the report for everybody, and then there are additional copies back here. I appreciate the opportunity to present this morning, and I'm going to refer a little bit to this Great Salt Lake Level Matrix at first. But first, in 2014, you're probably aware that at just 4,193 feet in elevation, the Great Salt Lake was at its lowest level since records began in 1850, except for the early 1960s. The 2013 Great Salt Lake Comprehensive Management Plan classifies a low lake level as 4,188 feet to 4,197 feet. The Great Salt Lake level matrix that you have in front of you, which is found in Appendix A of the Management Plan, shows 4,195 feet as a zone boundary transition. And at 4,190 feet and below, the matrix shows a very large number of adverse conditions in the various resources. One of the major impacts that should be considered at these low lake levels is the withdrawal of water from the Great Salt Lake for mineral extraction and other areas as well. I asked Dr. Johnny Moore if he would take a look at this concern. Dr. Moore is Professor Emeritus, Department of Geosciences, University of Montana. Using primarily the information and the comprehensive management plan, including this lake level matrix, Dr. Moore provided the preliminary assessment to help better understand potential impacts. The following are a few key points. When the Great Salt Lake is below 4,195 feet in elevation, mineral companies are essentially pumping water from the water body of the lake into their mineral ponds. The preliminary assessment indicates the effects of withdrawing water from the lake below an elevation of 4,195 feet to 4,188 feet based upon information in the lake level matrix and the management plan. And this information is summarized in Table 2 on page 5, so it's at the back, the last. And you can get a sense of that when you look at that table. I'll just give you one example. From Table 2 is if 300,000 acre-feet of water is withdrawn from the lake in 1 year, when the lake is between 4,195 to 4,188 feet in elevation, the lake would drop about 1/2 foot. This drop in level would accumulate each year when the lake is below 4,195 feet in elevation if the deficit is not made up by additional input to the lake. The preliminary assessment quantifies relationships between lake level and water withdrawals presented in the Great Salt Lake Comprehensive Management Plan. I encourage you to consider the information that it provides. And also, this type of detail should be further developed and included in the integrated water management model that we've just talked about a little bit. Just like to add one more thing. The conservation community is working on a brief issues paper regarding low lake levels. The Great Salt Lake Comprehensive Management Plan makes numerous recommendations for various resources at low lake levels, and this is an excellent resource to consider steps that should be taken on the Great Salt Lake. Two of the major issues that the conservation community thinks should be addressed are impacts to American white pelicans at Gunnison Island when the lake is below 4,193, and the impacts of mineral companies seeking to extend their canals for water withdrawals at levels below 4,193 feet. I wanted to make that very brief, and I appreciate the opportunity to take a few minutes to present to you.
You did good. You were under 5 minutes.
Hey, I was hoping I would do that.
Do we have any questions?
Is Gunnison Island still an island?
Well, there's a land bridge that starts opening up if the level goes low enough.
And it's essentially, it's like a land bridge now.
Okay. It's present now.
So we have, Mr. Chairman. We have some company people, salt extractors. Joe Havens, do you want to comment to what that was?
Before we do that, let me bring one thing up. We don't have, the Comprehensive Management Plan addresses, and we don't have authority over water rights. And so this is a water rights issue that needs to be resolved as part of any management structure for the Great Salt Lake. So recognizing that it's not really in our wheelhouse, other than we can comment on it, that's we need to make that clear. It's not something we can really we don't have authority anyway. But the only thing we have even purview over is the water rights issue. Joe, if you have a comment.
Sure. Yeah, we appreciate the paper and the thinking behind it and the work. Like most of you know, we're constantly engaged in trying to understand and hone and improve what we do almost on a daily basis. I think I speak for most of the extractive community on the lake. But being as granular, kind of a granular knowledge of the what's in the CMP that was referenced as not so much the core adjudicated water rights that were articulated, but the potential water rights that could be drawn on. There's a good amount of inaccurate information in the potential, sort of the approved but the approved but undeveloped and the unapproved water right categories are. For example, the unapproved water rate category is 85% too high. Compass Minerals is identified as one of those four rights that could be drawn on under that category. We withdrew that water rate application 2 years ago. So that's 85% of that total potential. And then when you look at the approved but undeveloped, yes, they're listed in the CMP, but a good amount of those water rights are actually not for evaporation purposes. They're used for management of ponds, and that water is brought into ponds late in the season where there's no evaporation. Okay, so it's used to bring back minerals that accumulated in the ponds and send it back to the lake. So there's de minimis, if that, evaporation. So I think that's, you know, overstated. You know, anywhere from 32% to 75%, just quickly looking at that. But again, we support, you know, ongoing science and understanding of our footprint and what we do. But I think we all need to be aligned around the right set of numbers.
Yeah. How many engaged water rights to get updated? Well, this data came from water rights. But they're old.
But they're you know, the ones that are used to manage ponds, that's fresh water that's
right.
That's brought through the ponds but then discharged, you know, just at about a 1-to-1 ratio in the fall. So you know, to say that's going to evaporate and be consumed on the lake, that's a misnomer.
Well, I think that the important thing to realize is that what we're looking at is the total body of information that we're trying to get at. I agree that we want to make sure everything that we put together is accurate. And it really highlights the fact that a gallon of water into the lake is an important gallon of water that we get there. So getting water there plus conserving water are all important. And that's what, I mean, we can't overlook all the components that the lake and the services the lake provides. And so I think that the information here is good to highlight and bring that out, maybe with some corrections. And probably, Joe, if you could send those to them, I'm sure they'd appreciate it.
Sure, I'd be happy to, you know, identify and sort of parse out which water rights mean what.
Yeah, that'd be great.
And if I just can comment, that table 5, or table 2 at the back on page 5, I do think that's a useful tool that people can use in regards to if you're withdrawing water from the lake upstream or when it's in the lake, then what is the impact on the lake? And it can be significant, especially if you're looking at some major water withdrawals. And I think that's one of the key points that we should be thinking about.
And I would agree. I mean, to understand, you know, to identify what an acre foot of water, how that relates at the various lake stages.
Right.
Because there's a continuum there as well,
right.
You know, based on the wetted surface area of the lake.
Right.
And Wayne, I think you make an excellent point. Whether it's a gallon taken by extractors or a gallon taken by farmers, it's the same.
Or a gallon taken by duck clubs and waterfowl management areas. Excuse me for saying that, but I started thinking about that this morning.
It's all the same as long as you're increasing the surface area.
So it's the same. Where does extractors to be singled out when it's a much bigger problem?
Yeah, it's one reason I wanted to highlight table 2 so that it relates to all potential water withdrawals.
Okay, as long as we're talking about extractors and commercial interests and the like, it reminds me sometimes you can kind of knee-jerk react one way or another on these kinds of issues. I think we've been really effective in balancing those issues. When we did the health study, we did the economic study. When we addressed the railroad causeway, there were those who said, well, this is a chance to go back to natural conditions and just remove it totally. Whereas I think as a council, we accepted status quo and looked to see how we could make improvements rather than make dramatic changes. I'm reminded that our economic study said that the lake produces approximately $1.3 billion a year for Utah's economy. And while Brian Schimper's elect takes some credit for that, the overwhelming majority of it is from the mineral extractors. I read in the Tribune this morning, who's our Tribune reporter?
You're done.
An article that said, just to put that in perspective, said over 20 years, the outdoor retailer shows, if any of you have ever been to those are huge, mm-hmm. those are really amazing, they bring tens of thousands of people here. Over 20 years, the outdoor retailer shows have generated nearly $500 million in spending. So the commercial activity in Great Salt Lake, do the math, is three times more in 1 year what the outdoor retailers bring to the state in 20 years. So it's a really major economic impact. And they rely, obviously, extraction involves some evaporation, but I don't think we're talking about going back and starting over. We're talking about making the best of what we have and trying to address the issues the best way we can. So appreciate your comments, Wayne, but I also appreciate yours, Joe and Tom, and hopefully we can not be too reactionary about it.
And that really, again, highlights the need for the integrated water model, because it will address all of these factors and talk about evaporation versus inflows and all how all those interplay. Any more questions or thoughts?
Well, I just want to make a comment thanking the Advisory Council once again for commissioning that study on the economic significance of the lake. I can't tell you how often I find out on that study. Thank you.
Any other comments? If not, appreciate your comments, Wayne, in the report. We have you here,
Well, Bill Gander's not here, but Erica and Gavin.
Erica, are you Bill?
I'm Bill today.
Yeah. Way to go, Erica. You're looking pretty good. A lot better than Bill.
Do you have an extra report?
Jody's going to put up a slide, but just want to make sure everyone's aware with respect to the Union Pacific Railroad's 401 water quality certification. We expect that to go out for public notice today, the latest tomorrow.
Everybody hear that today?
Today or tomorrow will be a 30-day public comment period, and we really are at the end of our timeline. We have 1 year to act on an application. Their original application came in January 7th of 2014. We've done an administrative withdrawal to get a couple weeks extension. We've been working really hard with the railroad to make some adjustments to the comprehensive monitoring and mitigation plan over the course of this last year. We think we've made pretty good progress. We've got most of what we'd like to see in there. Anything else at this point will become a condition in their water quality certification. So we've got a draft of that. We're just putting the final touches on it this morning, and it should go out shortly. Just to remind everybody that the objective of the project is to duplicate as closely as possible the transfer of water salt that was occurring with the culverts fully functioning as documented in November 2012. That's the purpose of their project. I think the thing to keep in mind is that what we've gotten, what we will get out of this project is the ability to manage potentially adaptively the salt transfer between the north and south arm. And so that's something that we haven't had previously and we're pretty excited about, but is sort of beyond the objective of the railroads project. So 30 days, yeah, John.
And just a couple of quick questions. So the invert elevation as constructed would be 4183. Mm-hmm. It'll have the ability for adaptive management to lower or raise that level through addition or removal of fill. And it's still the intention for them to start construction this spring and complete it this fall.
That is the goal.
The reason I asked
those. We've got some other issues to work out with respect to their
The reason I asked those three questions is the position that we took as a council was that we were supportive of this bridge project, provided those three things happened. That the invert elevation was at least 4183, that it was adaptively managed, could be adaptively managed, and that it would go forward quickly since the culverts have been closed for a while. Yep. And our objective as a council was, at the least, to provide for no further net migration of salt from south to north. And we thought this would, based on the modeling, would accomplish that objective.
Yep. That's right. And I mean, all of the work we've been doing is sort of laying the groundwork for how we would go about making those adjustments in the first 5 years should there be, if they're outside of their performance standards. So what will be out in our package for public comment is the statement of basis that summarizes the project, the actual water quality certification, including our conditions, their comprehensive monitoring and mitigation plan, which for the most part we're adopting into our certification with some modifications that are outlined in our conditions. And then two anti-degradation reviews. One is a level one review for the permanent closure of the culverts, and then also our level two anti-degradation review is out for public comment on the temporary closure from last year. So we're putting it all out for comment, and we think it's pretty robust. We have to we have to either deny or approve by March 2nd, or we lose our ability to do that. So we'll be moving quickly after February 20th.
But the document for review is to review, approve it, right? Or is it just your decision is to approve, right?
Well, we would like, we're proposing that this would be I don't see anything that would cause us to deny the application at this point.
With the conditions.
With the conditions.
4-1 water quality certification with conditions, and the conditions are important.
Yes, sir.
So who does the review? You guys?
Which review?
So the
anti-degradation review?
Yes.
Yes. Well, so they've provided an analysis that...
Who does the changing? The railroad?
So for the first 5 years, if they're... So here's the thing. If they're not meeting that objective, which is a pretty narrow objective, to duplicate the former salt and water transfer, they're on the hook for changing it during the 5 year. We've proposed a 5 year monitoring period. Outside of that, so in the longer term, that's still to be kind of negotiated.
That's what's being negotiated in our lease.
Yeah. I can't hear you. Have it written down.
That's what. Still not my favorite. That's what's being negotiated in our lease. The lease we proposed is that they would manage the berm. And circulation and navigation in perpetuity.
Okay.
But.
Not the berm is not including the shoe fly, right? So the shoe fly is a separate issue on that.
The shoe fly will come out after they've done the construction, is my understanding.
What's your timing on those lease negotiations? Mm-hmm. You have a similar deadline?
4 years ago? So we're not really, we're slowly making progress. I think we have another phone call on Friday, but we're not.
Do you expect to be done in time for them to construct this spring?
That's up to them. We can be, if we get something back in the next couple of weeks, we can be done, but I would not say I'm overly optimistic about them making that happen. I mean, that could all change. It's the ball's in their court at this point. They have our proposed lease. They, at one point, sent back a lease proposal that didn't meet state statute rule or anything. We couldn't entertain it at all. So
they've made it clear that March 2nd is also their deadline for construction this year.
But, I mean, we'll do everything we can to make that happen, but it takes them being responsive.
Jill?
Erica, the tech team meeting in September last year, Utah State did a presentation where they came up with some different modeling outcomes. Has there been a reconciliation between what the UP's modeling shows versus the Utah State? I wasn't quite understanding or on board with what Utah State was assuming, benchmarking zero flow through culverts.
Right.
You know, as the benchmark, but there, I haven't seen any.
I don't think so, and the railroad us are relying on that USGS model. They've got the original modelers on their team. So it's a good question, though. We should probably.
Wasn't the USU modeling based on a prior version of their proposal as well?
It was.
Yeah.
But
there was, could be a reconciliation.
The outcome was drastically different than the parallel track in the USGS, and it kind of, you know, raised some questions for us, you know, just to have that reconciliation. Because I think Utah State was saying they were baselining that on
zero flow,
you know, through the existing culverts, and that's not.
And through the causeway, we know there's some exchange through the causeway itself.
So everything was incremental, you know, so no flow to a bridge.
Right.
There's a lot of delta in there. But
they use a different geometry, too, for the bridge. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a trapezoid, it was just a culvert, square culvert.
Didn't we leave that meeting and they said they were going to modify their...
Did you hear?
I haven't heard, but I'll follow up to see if they...
Did you give them money to do that?
Was that a...
Yeah, but not a follow-up. I mean, that was kind of like that concluded their grant, but I can follow up.
If we were to have a question, it would be around that reconciliation that you know, you made.
It's good to know.
The model was peer-reviewed. The bridge model was peer-reviewed by USGS, who originated the model. But you can't hurt to have an extra check. It's just we're worried now because it's getting so
pretty. But if they could talk, you know, point by point, well, sure. Utah State's assuming this. We don't think it's relevant because of this and this. That would be helpful to reconcile.
Yeah.
So, Erica, does that look at that language? Duplicate as closely as possible to transfer water and salt. Vote of support was based on a minimum transfer of water that was documented at that time. Those two are a little incongruous, wouldn't you say? Because I think that, as I recall our conversation as the board, is that if there were more water and salt transferring to more appropriate, equalized, you know, both sides of the culvert, then we would be supportive of that. But that language doesn't state that. It would mean that they would actually have to make modifications if there were more salt or water flowing from south and north than what was happening in 2012. Am I saying that correctly?
I'll respond.
Well, you can go ahead, Bob.
He'll
I wasn't here when you guys.
You can go ahead, Eric, and then he'll correct you.
I don't remember exactly. Okay.
Now, there's really two different issues here. One is what the agencies can require of the railroad legally.
Yes.
Is what's up here.
Right.
Our objective was similar but a little bit different.
Okay.
And the railroad's modeling tends to err on our side.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we selected that alternative.
I'm just hoping that they're not going to do something that would be inconsistent with. There's enough latitude in there, in their concept of duplicate as closely as possible.
Well, that's the fourth
goal.
Our
ultimate goal is to get out from under this objective. Ultimately, we would like to have, we now have this tool to design an objective that's more meaningful for Lincoln.
I think for what you want and what we wanted, it's good.
Okay.
But this is what, I mean, under the 404 process, this is what we can... This is what was put into their report. They have to base, because what the actual action was the closing of these culverts. So this bridge is mitigation for that closure, and all we can require is that they replace that aquatic function. Today, what they're giving us is a tool to manage the lake adaptively into the future, and those objectives can be broader in the future. Is that? Answer.
Yeah, I just, you know, they're, okay, I'll stop.
No, that's a good question.
Yeah. Okay, well, my response would just be that, you know, there was the law of unintended consequences when it was put in the first place. There was no understanding of what might happen. And what happened was a significant difference between the two sides of the lake and to... It's unfortunate that there's no legal ability to, at this opportunity,
write that?
I think there is that opportunity.
Okay.
It's just it's step two.
Okay.
First we get the tool.
Okay.
Well, it's never going to be the same as if the causeway didn't exist.
And we may not want it to be.
Right.
We don't.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, it's just a...
Is there a range of a desirable monitoring period that's been discussed? I know water quality is 5 is fine. What about state lands?
So our proposal, because we do, like, we pay for monitoring. We pay USGS to monitor and EES and water quality. So we would continue to monitor, and then we would, after this 5-year period, sort of, this is all still working out, but work with stakeholders to figure out what the range is and if whether we're in that.
Okay.
In perpetuity is what we're proposing.
Do you know what? Oh, good. Do you know what the Corps is interested in as far
theirs
as
would be the same as?
No.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was like 8, 6 or 8 or something.
We're coordinating.
Pardon me?
No, ask Eric.
She's my
new boss.
On theirs, but I think they might be looking at a longer period than we are talking about. But all the details.
There's still a lot of things that are kind of in flux that we're trying to work out with our end of the railroad. But that's our current proposal right now.
And the 5 years would be assuming no need to make modifications, if all things go well. You know, we've got contingencies in there for. Should we need to make adjustments, then we might need additional time.
Yeah, if they make adjustments within that 5-year period, potentially, then it starts over.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mr. Chairman, good question. On there, I mean, monitoring sounds like pretty standard, you know, program. But if there were any modifications that need to be made, that's where the expense comes in. Me, I get a little bit concerned that, you know, that close to having a lease signed and that they're going to start construction and there's no liability on the back end, or that hasn't been ironed out. Because if you get into it 6 years and there's major modifications that need to be done, who's on the hook for it?
I don't think they can start construction.
They can start construction without a permit from us. At least that's what we're maintaining right now. So, because right now the causeway, where they want to construct the bridge, they have no permit to even be where they're at.
Because of the easement?
They've never obtained an easement. The railroad maintains that they have a federal right to be there, but they've never produced the documentation to show us that, and we don't believe that they can. So,
okay.
I mean, that if you know, I mean, that gets into a lot of legal questions. What happens if they get a permit from DEQ and they start construction? What do we do? I mean, that's a whole, that gets way above what my decision-making powers are, so.
No, that's just a concern because
it's
you put a shovel in the ground, you lose all bargaining.
Well, and we're in communication with the governor's office, and
okay.
You know they're aware of the situation, and you know, well, we don't sleep well at night. So.
Yeah, we're all a little nervous, but we certainly don't want to lose our authority if you know the issue is. So we're at the end of our.
Well, and I think if they know that it's a hard and fast deadline and that they're not going to be able to do it, it's going to hold them up, maybe they'll...
She'll see.
She'll see emergency.
But it's kind of like any permit, you know, permit leases we give, you know, you have the right to do what's on our property, and you know, we have the legal authority to give you, but we can't give you someone, you know, we can't usurp somebody else's authority, so it's kind of what we're
saying. Same with us, right?
Yeah. We've kind of tied each other into each other's permits.
Unified, as you should, being the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Quality together. Mm-hmm. State of the
Didn't when at the Great Salt Lake Tech Team meeting, when Kathleen Anderson was there, didn't she make mention of some sort of liability bonding or financial commitment that
mm-hmm.
the railroad was going to be working through with the Corps, which is a pretty standard practice?
Right. She was making it sound like that was almost finalized, but it wouldn't be shared with the public.
Right.
We're having an agency meeting with the Corps, DNR, EPA's flying in on Monday. So maybe we'll pass it to you.
I thought I understood
interested in the liability or the bonding with for the 5 years that they're responsible.
Right, and then they get that back.
Yeah, and then they get that back, and then we have to have some mechanism in place that if we wanted as a state to adjust that bridge, how that would work.
And that's what we're trying to work out.
And who would pay for it.
Right,
that's
what we're working
out
right now.
Just like the commission.
Because any permit we give now, we don't take, the state doesn't take any authority or ownership of anything that's constructed for a private or even a public improvement, so to speak. So, you know, that's just not how we operate. Like, you can't construct a bridge over the Jordan River and then expect the state to maintain it. You know, whoever constructs the bridges has it as valid. So that's what we're contending, is that they're gaining a private benefit by crossing the lake. Therefore, they have to maintain the public aspects of, you know, circulation and navigation. But we'll see how that plays out.
Isn't the real problem that you have a limited amount of leverage over them because their problem was the collapsing culverts? They've solved their problem. They don't need this bridge for their operation. They only need this bridge to meet this.
Were you in our conference room today?
Yes. So you take a real strong stand, and the likelihood is that it'll just be delayed because there's no compelling reason for them to move forward this year as opposed to next year. The compelling reason is that we've lost the bidirectional flow and things are going the wrong direction from how we'd like them to go. And the longer we wait, the worse that gets. Mm-hmm. And so you're in an awkward situation where you have a lot of leverage, but not really over them.
Right.
Well, we would have leverage to issue a notice of violation once this process is complete in the Corwood as well.
Because the culverts are closed and they haven't got a remedy.
Unless they want to reopen the culvert.
And that notice of violation would amount to what?
An order to build a bridge. That's just what they...
That they can't build because they don't have authority from your system.
That's why we're trying to work with them. But at the same time, we don't want to just allow them to build a bridge and then we're in charge of the maintenance of it, because I don't think long term that that's sustainable, and I don't see the railroad ever allowing us to go out and do maintenance or do any sort of construction activities along there.
Well, you've got, there's maintenance and there's modification.
Right.
I mean, maintenance is one thing that I would think that at the end of the day, they're willing to take care of maintenance. If you want to go out and make major modifications, I think you're going to look around and say, how about the other users in the room? Why aren't they part of this?
They didn't build it.
Well, they promised for in perpetuity to do the operation maintenance, and that's in that comprehensive modification plan.
The modification
is what we're trying to figure out, because,
And is it the state's, I don't think it's the state's, is the public's responsibility to make modifications to something that the railroad constructed. I mean, that's what we're trying to work out right now. I mean, we don't do that for anyone else. And when, by doing that, I mean, it gives us some sort of liability. I mean, it takes on a whole bunch of things that I don't think we're going to take on. I mean, we're dealing with the same thing on the Tusher Dam on the Green River that it never allowed boat passage, and now they're going to rebuild it. And we said, you have to allow boat passage, and they said, that's fine, but you're going to pay to maintain it. And we said, no, you're just not going to get a new dam. I mean, you're getting a private benefit, so you have to be willing to hold up the public trust by getting that.
But benefit. You've got a process in mind for how that could work.
Yeah, we have a process, and we're trying to work it through. I mean, it has to do with, like, their lease funds going into potentially an account that could then be used to pay them to do modifications. But I just don't see from a liability standpoint, if I were the railroad, I wouldn't let the lowest bidder from the state contractor go out and start making modifications anywhere near my structure.
Unless the only alternative is for the railroad itself to spend the money, and then they might be more than willing to let someone else fund it.
I think we've got a funding.
I think we're working through it. A lot of it depends on what the railroad, I mean, it's kind of, I mean, really, it's in their court what their response is. So.
But you bring up a good point, is that we want to get a bridge built. We have restricted circulation right now. The goal is to get the bridge built, and so we have to commence and we're hoping through the 4-1 water quality cert and the 4-4 permit that that is required.
But they also, I mean, when we built a causeway, you know, when we started 100 years ago, nobody we want to make sure that we anticipate what's going to happen, because I don't think anybody anticipated even the rock fill causeway to cause as much, you know, dichotomy in the North Arm and South Arm. And so let's make sure that we have mechanisms in place that we don't end up in similar situations, you know, 50 years from now or 10 years from now.
The thing is, for the new members, they came in a couple of years ago, maybe three, in July, up at the Pioneer State Park, and they said, we're the railroad, we have a national permit, we're going to do exactly as we want to, and this is an emergency because the culverts are fading. Well, it's been quite a while since that July meeting.
2011.
Wasn't it 2011? Yeah. So that emergency was okay for them to close the culverts, but it offset everything. So their big deal is, well, we're not morally obligated. Well, we'll find out.
They're legally
obligated, but they feel like they don't have anything to do with that consequence.
The permit they have with the Corps right now is a temporary closure, which I'm not sure if it's practical, you know, if the Corps could say, we'll reopen the culverts, you know, dig all the riprap and materials out. I don't know how practical that is, but they are riding right now on a temporary.
This is the permanent.
Let's go ahead and bring this to a close, because we're not going to resolve this, but we're hoping you will, in accordance with what Don mentioned, which was our goal is to have no net migration, and the elevation and the adjustability. So, and if people have questions or concerns, they ought to comment once the 404 permit is out for public comment.
So it's going to be on our website, the Division of Water Quality's website. It's on our Pelicanos page, and there's a special page for this as well. But I can send out a link to everybody on the council and the stakeholder list that I have.
So make sure you look at the conditions and the CMMP, because they go together.
Okay.
Do you want to skip me and then go on?
No, we're going to go to you.
Okay.
Well, we'll skip you for a minute.
Okay. Yeah.
Let's go down to the annual report. Don?
Yeah. So I was volunteered to write the text again. I've got some copies. Since it's in draft form, this is for members only. Thank you. Passing around. And so we follow the same format. Now, what I'd like you to focus on is more the substance here. We have a cover page that's not changed except for an image, and the image you see here is not the image that we're going to use. We had four or five options, and this is just the one that was printed out. The image that will be on the front is of the Great Salt Lake Wetlands. It's quite a nice image, and we haven't really captured that on our report previously. So inside the first page, we repeat our duties, legislative duties, and then assess how we've met those. And then we highlight three issues of the year in kind of a report format on page three. First one is Great Salt Lake Salinity, the railroad causeway modification, and it goes through and summarizes our subcommittee, what we did, what our positions were. And that last paragraph is specifically the three questions that I had posed earlier. The second one is the integrated water resources management model, which came to fruition in 2014, and our role in that important issue. And then we typically address comment on a new or potential new issue, and the one that we put in here is impacts of Bear River diversions. In October, that issue was raised by the briefing on the plan. And our response to that, although we need to delve into it further, was that we felt as a advisory council that we needed to make sure that the downstream issues were addressed and by adequate research study, et cetera, and that that would be a good niche for where we could find some commonality as a group. So those were the three highlight issues. And then the back page, as always, is a summary of the meetings we had. We had five formal meetings last year, and this is just a brief summary of those meetings. I noted that on the
the list of council members, because this is a report for last year's activities, we would leave Commissioner Tingey and Commissioner, yeah, but we need to change Carlton Christensen because he was replaced early in the year by Caitlin, I believe, as the city representative.
And we probably need to replace Commissioner Scott for Tingey.
Yeah, and Scott for Tingey.
Yeah, I was sworn in January last year, and I think they finally got me approved in June.
So those are the two changes we would make in the list on the back. What I'd ask members to do is to look at the substance and the text. And if by the end of this week, if you have any comments or concerns, let me know. If there are a few typos and a few missing things, like on page 2 at the bottom left-hand side, it's got four items listed, 1, 2, 3, 4. There's supposed to be a fifth, which says report annually to the natural resources appropriations. It's left blank there. But the other typos are quite minor and have been or will be corrected. It's our intention to get this revised in the next couple of weeks. Its date has a February 2015 date, and it serves as our report to the legislature. So, any comments or questions from members? Big thanks to the Nature Conservancy for providing the layout and the graphic, all of that work. Chris, thank you very much. That's really the most important part of this. So,
thanks to Don, though, for the work of writing it all.
Yeah.
Much harder.
Not to put words in the advisory council's mouth, but are you hoping to get an administrative, a full-time administrative person to work with the council and act as a liaison? Other entities?
If you're asking in the context of the report, I didn't. It's mentioned in here in one of our meeting reports. But the fact of the matter is, it was. You want to tend to kind of focus on the things that where you're making progress and accomplishments. That was a request that we made that didn't even make it to the governor's budget.
Okay.
And so we're going to have to regroup and figure out plan B really going forward on that. And so I didn't want to highlight it here. This is a report to the legislature. didn't make it to the governor's budget, not likely going to be successful thereafter. So we need to regroup and figure out how to start our second barrage on that. So.
Thank you.
And then, as Don mentioned, the building block was submitted by Forestry Fire through to the governor's office. It just didn't make it out of the governor's office. No real reason to know exactly what stopped it. What who? At least that's what Brian said.
Yeah, I don't think.
So, but they're committed to do it again for next year, and we probably just need to spend some time, if necessary, with the staff at the governor's office to make sure they understand the importance of it.
And so, I would say the same, if you guys feel it's important, talk to the legislature this year, too.
Yeah, although chances of getting it without being a building block are pretty slim.
Yeah, I'm just saying, good problem.
I mean, we'd have to have a pretty powerful legislator to say, I want it. So I think the plan is to see if we can find some funding to do some consulting help for a while. But
in the interim, we have a riches here, right? We have a whole bunch of agency people working for us.
Yeah.
Laura, and Eric, and Jody.
Okay, any other questions on the integrated, on the report? The report, as Don mentioned, will go to the entire legislature, and after discussions with the committee that we report to, we will not be making an in-person report to the committee. So this will serve as our update as statutory required.
So again, by Friday, any comments or edits or changes?
And if you have a comment, send them to Don. Any questions?
Just on the staffing question, I don't know if everyone knows that Jody's moved into a management role. So her position is now, our Great Salt Lake coordinator position is now vacant.
Yeah, but we're still considering Jody R, so we don't really care what you guys do in the house.
There will be a new face at some point.
As long as Jody comes too, we don't care. We don't have any other issues that are going to be directly to the legislature this year. So unless somebody brings something up on that, we have handed out the matrix that we prepared a couple of years ago that Eric was involved in preparation of. And in that, we talk about what we think are the potentially research topics, but research is actually what leads us to knowledge about management. And so these are the research topics that we proposed. There are a number of these that we've already actioned, but what we really ought to be doing is saying, are there issues or items on here that we want to specifically focus on for the next year and trying to get funding for over and above what we've already done.
Can so, you identify the highest ranking items here that are not currently being addressed?
I don't believe the mapping of the West Wetlands, is that being...
Yeah,
we're doing it.
You're doing that one. Mm-hmm. So the model is done. We have the initial phase of the water quality work. That's what we got through the Water Quality Board that Don and I were talking with them on. The nutrient issue is kind of sort of, I know that you had mentioned that Dave Nass is updating his model, which is a lake-wide nutrient model. We are, my wastewater research group is working on a Farmington Bay update for the nutrients going into Farmington Bay so that we can have those models available. We've already completed a model on the hydraulics of hydrology of Farmington Bay, and the that was reported on last year. We had some Dr. Steve Burian from the university come in and discuss that. So we're going to be populating that model with nutrient data in the very near future.
And DWQ will be doing a synthesis this year. We see six studies that have been done recently or will be completed recently around nutrients and cyanobacteria. So the one you did, Eric McCulley's thesis, our Willard Spur study, which is nutrient-related, should be finished this summer. The paleo study is now complete and on our website, including an independent review if anyone wants to have a look at that. Help me. The others are
and the
Dave Knapp's.
The Dave Knapp's and the Steve Burian.
Yeah. So.
Now, Leland funded the two projects that with the nutrient signer. Well, not Leland personally, Essential Data Sewage.
The ecology at the very bottom of the first page on the Phragmites, we have funding, the forestry fire has some funding for that, and are looking at any, have you guys looked at a management structure for that on the lake yet? Well, do you know what you're going to do?
Yeah, so we got $300,000
right
this year, and we've got the guy, actually they just started trampling all the frag we sprayed yesterday. So they're going to trample a few hundred acres of frag. I think 824 is in the contract. And then in the governor's budget, we have another $200,000 one-time money and $100,000 ongoing, and then $50,000 to research the great, because we put a lot of grazing on the frag money, but we really don't know what the long-term impacts are. And so another $50,000 one-time for grazing impacts. And we've got, I mean, we have a plan, so I think we're moving right ahead on that. It's just a huge undertaking.
If you add all that up, how much is that?
For the Great Salt Lake, over the last, well, potentially over 3 years, would be close to $1 million. Which is about, I mean, $300,000 is about as much as we can practically spend in a year.
So is it your policy to eradicate or to feed?
Well, that's, so we're hoping for eradication, and that's what we're hoping on the grazing study, is whether, because we're thinking that the grazing is actually allowing, once you take the cattle off at certain times of year, allowing some native vegetation to come back. But if it's not, then maybe we need to rethink, you know, just look at what the other options are. Grazing is our best and cheapest tool right now to keep it mowed down, so to speak, but we're not sure if that long-term, how sustainable that is, and so that's what we're hoping to achieve.
But I think the answer to the question was, it's manage, not eradicate.
Right. Like on Bear Lake, it's eradicate. Like Bear Lake and certain places around Utah Lake, we can't eradicate. Great Salt Lake, you know, give us 10 years and I'll let you know how we're doing.
Okay, I'll put that on the calendar.
Okay. I'll still be here.
Chris?
Can we go on to another topic?
I mean, down the list?
Another on the list?
Yeah.
I think, or did we finish up with?
Well, I was just going to come to on the second page, you have the deep brine layer dynamics. That has not been looked at the level that this is proposed.
We've loaded that a few times in Hot Topics. So I just don't think we have the money there.
So that one would need additional funding if it's really going to be done. The mineral and hydrocarbon on the second page would be part and parcel with the modeling, the water resource modeling. So once that's available, that would be there. And then we go into, after that, we're into the medium one. So the hydrodynamics and the deep brine layer is probably the only one of the high priority projects that doesn't have at least some indirect work being done on it already. So with that, what?
You skipped page 3 here?
You know what, page 3 goes into the medium. Okay, so we have on page 2 with the high priority ones, the urgency is high, was the deep brine layer dynamics. It's the only one that is not being at least partially addressed currently or waiting on the integrated water resource model to get final evaluation capabilities. So, Chris, with that, go ahead.
Yeah, it's occurred to me and others in the last year or two that there is an issue that's related to lake level and low lake level, especially in water withdrawals of all kinds, that we sort of are starting to mention in conversations as being a possible important factor, but we basically have no idea if it is or not, and that's the air quality beyond just dust particles, which we have. So it's kind of buried loosely on page 5, air and climate. But I think how we thought of it 4 years ago or whenever this list was put together was kind of just dust, particulate matter in the air, rather than what's in the dust. And we... I just don't know. We put every conceivable thing we can think of in Farmington Bay over the last 100 years, and as that sediment is exposed and we have wind events, which we know we have wind events, and some transfer of whatever is there into the communities along the lake shoreline, it's no big problem at all, could be significant. We just don't know, and to me it seems like maybe not, it should, you know, take all our focus, but we should start talking about how to get a handle on that question and with some credible research and monitoring about what is or isn't in that dust that people are starting breathing more and more at lower and lower lake levels. So it's just a...
So you arguing this item should be expanded or should just be moved up the list?
I think it needs to be expanded because unless the dust is truly inert and it's just particulates in the air that we're breathing, you know, is there something harmful in that dust transfer or not? Maybe there isn't, but I think if there is, it's going to elevate itself as a very important topic for research. And because it is so directly related to how much surface area of sediment is exposed and growing population, everything else, maybe we should start having some conversations with the agencies or among ourselves somehow, just advance towards trying to solve that unknown.
You know, one of the ways of addressing that in context of a hydrodynamic model and otherwise is to couch it in the terms that we're looking at what the effects of extremely low lake levels are across the Wasatch Front, not just to the lake level affecting the in-lake population, but the but that effect on the human population that may be situated along the front if dust storms were to occur, like at Owens Lake in California or something like that to occur.
Division of Air Quality had a pretty sizable research budget this, this year.
About Great Salt Lake, no. But about the bed?
It's, I mean, it'll go, it's open, but I think they'll compete that much.
Could we possibly get Air Quality to come and talk to us at the next meeting? To address the concept of, is there something they're doing relative to this? You know, what do they look at?
Yes,
you know, do
yeah.
they look about the pickup of dust off the lake or something like that, if it's possible? See whether or not they're willing to do that. But I think that that's an important factor because if the lake level continues to go low, that has a significant potential impact. Mm-hmm. There is also the other side of that equation, which when you talk about air quality, impacts on the lake, and that's what comes, not just dust, but otherwise into the lake as a result of airborne pollutants. Other items that we would like to look at on the research list that people feel need to be addressed.
Did you get your answer to your question if we should invite someone from Air Quality?
I think Erica said she's going to handle that.
I saw a lot of nodding.
Erica and Jody said they will take care of seeing if they can be here.
They're a little busy right now, I hear. Yeah. Quality folks, but we will ask.
That's what I was telling you. I don't think they would take a call from anybody in Box Elder or Weaver.
Last
yeah,
Joel
well,
was on the yeah, he was at the forum last
tell me, we promised not to mention wood burning stoves, so it's okay.
Yeah.
No wood burning stove discussion.
Yeah. Other items that people feel we should look at? So let's let everybody have a chance to look at this again. I think we'll look at this air quality, water quality nexus, population health nexus, and see if we can move that up a little bit higher and see if we can look at how we can address that issue as well as potentially find funding for it. If not,
Lena, there was one other high priority. I didn't mention it was the updated salt balance and development of planning horizon for mineral extraction.
I indicated that the salt balance would be part of the integrated water resource model. I mean, if you have the model, you're able to more fully complete an analysis of salt balance. Okay. So the model is what gives us the ability of being able to draw salt balance into that equation, looking at the TDS and the materials coming in and flows coming in, and then we can tie that to extraction and look at that on a annual versus long-term process.
It's nice to see the progress down the list.
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. I see something we're getting there on something. The next one would be addressing any topics for future meetings and meeting dates. We've tried to say Wednesdays, and we tried. At one point, it was like the last Wednesday of the month, or the second to the last, or something like that.
First
Wednesday of the month.
Yeah.
So, does the first Wednesday of the month still kind of sort of work?
Which means
which month?
Every other month. So we would be now March, and it would be the 4th. And then May, it would be the 6th.
Will they be at 11 every time?
That's what we have done. Because people suggested that they like to be able to go get other things started before they got here. So.
3, 4, and 11.
And then July would be the 1st.
5, 3.
September would be the 2nd. Then November would be the 4th. So if that works, or at least tentatively, we'll send that out with the I've asked one of you two to send it out to everybody suggesting that those are the dates for the meetings this year, including today. The other topics that we'd like to address, we're going to continue on with some additional information on Bear River. We've got this air quality one that we've added to the list. What other subjects have people have an interest in that they want to listen to or talk about?
I've heard rumblings about a possible expansion of the causeway, and I don't know if there's any traction behind that or if that's coming into play with any of your...
Are you talking about for the landfill?
Landfill, access, you know, just to...
So my conversations with the railroad were big no way, no how, not ever, but that, I'm not necessarily... Who knows what they're saying not to me, but that was the conversation. When the folks that wanted to expand a landfill came and talked to us, and then we talked to the railroad, they said that would be a hard... I said, well, you should probably have an easement because we could just, you know, lease it, the existing causeway to the landfill.
No, I just heard rumblings again, and I thought if there is any traction behind that, it would make sense to do it at the same time and some planning, but...
We haven't heard anything about the landfill for probably 6 months or more. I don't know if you know anything.
Not as much as I'd like to.
I know that was one of the possible prison relocation sites was the landfill.
It would make,
it was on the map.
Well, we joke.
They put a lot of things on the map to fire people up.
We joke about
obviously, we're pretty good.
It would be a phenomenal place for the prison because it's so remote, there's nothing out there, and nobody would want to escape. If they did, they would come back.
Yeah, where the landfill is.
Pioneer Times, they used Fremont Island as a prison.
Yeah.
You know, the modern day problem with moving the prison away from the interstate is that there are hundreds of volunteers that work at the prison every day, and there are a need for getting those people back and forth between courts and medical treatment and so forth. They're going to be somewhere close to an interstate. They're not.
And that's the only reason it would work is if it was expanded, because then you're 15, 20 minutes out of going on 12th Street.
Yeah, but I mean, I think they're
looking... But other than that,
they're going to build it, they're going to build it northwest of the airport. But, you know,
so, okay. Or different discussion, but...
Or somewhere, yeah.
Other...
Where it's at. I don't know if it's substantial enough to have time dedicated to it, but the proposed UTTR expansion, I know it's not in the lake, but it's certainly adjacent to it, the test and training range.
That would be a good subject.
The land swap and the basis for the what's being swapped out. What the state's getting, or I guess what the feds are getting.
And part of the expansion was touch the shoreline of the Great Salt Lake.
What are you talking about?
Utah Test and Training Range, where they go out and strafe things.
Jets.
Come out to Magnesium Tuesday, Thursday nights in the summer. You can watch the Air National Guard's practice.
We had them, when we had the Exploratory Council, we called them to have them give a presentation, and it was going up the ranks, and then finally they called the colonel, and then they said no.
Just because they could talk about the expansion. I mean, I know it's been we've spent some time on the phone.
Do you have that comment?
If there is enough information or enough interest, let me know. It's Chris Robinson. And he is a retired colonel, and he's the one that's working on the expansion.
No, I think that'd be good if you want to.
We've met with him several times, and they've been really good too.
If you wouldn't mind making a contact and see if they'd be willing to do it one of those dates.
They're more than willing to talk to all the stakeholders right now, because basically it's a buffer zone. It's not going to be an area where you're going to see live ordnance flying over. It's just in case, and so they want to be good neighbors. So I can talk to him.
That'd be great.
Leland, I would like to mention the Great Salt Lake Comprehensive Management Plan. In that plan, there are numerous recommendations about the lake at low lake levels. And in that plan, the low lake level is below 41, I can't remember, but below where it is now. And I think it would be useful to really review all of those recommendations and see what was said in the plan and see what kinds of directions should be taken based upon that plan.
Good subject.
Dan, I can't remember, Julie, if you were at the, there was a Utah Lake Commission and Jordan River Commission joint meeting in December that I thought was really interesting for those two groups to come together. And one thing that was floated was for this group to maybe meet jointly with either just the Jordan River Commission or also Utah Lake, because the groups try to manage their resources.
Yeah, what? Yeah. Let me, I will be meeting with those two groups tomorrow.
Okay.
But let me address what the question is. The
big sigh. Yeah.
Well, because everybody wants money, right? That's the issue. And so they're proposing, one of their specific proposals that they would like to carry forward is to have a block of money. And you can talk up on this forum all if you want to, or Vernon. But a block of money that's available to forestry fire to do works on state lands. On the issues that come out as a restricted account. So the restricted account is populated almost entirely by the industries on the lake, and they would like to see a way of getting some of that money released so that the state land issues, both the lake as well as the Jordan River, Utah Lake, and I suppose Bear Lake, would all have a call on some of that funding and to be allocated by the division in some judicious manner. Right now, for the division to get money out of the restricted fund, they have to go back each year to the legislature.
Why would we ever support taking that money and allocating it outside the Great Salt Lake?
I'm not sure we would.
The majority of it's from the Great Salt Lake, but we also have money made on leasing other.
Right.
We do all the oil, gas, and carbon, hydrocarbon leasing for the state other than Scylla, so we have royalties from that and. Permitting, leasing on the Green and Colorado River, permit fees on the Bear Lake, Utah Lake.
So you see it as a vehicle for us being able to get our hands on the, if you're opening it up for them, they can open it up for us?
Well, I think the point is to get an ongoing, like most land management agencies, like state parks, they have an ongoing appropriation, so they know each year how much money they have and what sort of capital improvements or what they're going to do. We don't have that. We have to go ask. We come up with a plan every year, go ask for money, maybe get some of it, and then have to go back every year. So I think correct me if I'm wrong, what we're hoping is to get an ongoing appropriation. We can say these are what we want to do this year, but know how much year-to-year funding we would get to do project work, and then work with, the different resources and commissions to allocate that funding.
And would you allocate that kind of more or less pro rata with the source of the money? I mean, if the Great Salt Lake's the source of most of it, the Great Salt Lake would get most of it?
Well, I mean, that could be determined, but it's not how it works now. I mean, the Great Salt Lake probably gets the majority of it right now anyway, but we also, do eradication on Utah Lake and Jordan River and Green and Colorado Rivers. And
what's happening now is that the account gets large, and then other people take it to fund the state fair or
state grouse,
which is not a bad thing in and of itself. But if we could focus it on sovereign lands, whether it's Jordan River, I'd rather see it for Jordan River sovereign lands versus sage grouse down south. So,
I did.
Well, so I went to the meeting at in Lehigh. Mm-hmm. It was harder to find than this was. No, really. But it was, and this wasn't easy. So I went down there, and this lady gets up and says that she wants to get $4 million out of the Mineral Release Fund. And then I got up and I said, no, not any of you put a penny into that fund. But if there's areas where we can agree to do something, maybe we can look at it. That's because, we get a lot of water from it. Not all the water, but we get a lot of water from the lake, Utah Lake, and the canal. And I learned to water ski in that canal. But the thing is that they never said what they wanted to do with the money. They never didn't say they were going to do anything with the money, whether or not it was going to be the fragmites, and that's what I
I'd rather have them do is get rid of that. Then you do have an access water flow that's going to come without being balled up with phragmites. But when Leland talked to me earlier, he said, well, they think you're in favor of that. And I said, I'm in favor where we agree, but I'm not going to lead the charge to get $4 million for a group to never put a cent into it.
Which is exactly why it might be helpful for these two groups to.
We're going to meet with the executive director from the two tomorrow. I'm going to meet with them. With I think Brian's going to be there too. Are you there, Laura?
Yeah.
So it'll be, and it's at your office.
It's in
the Great Salt Lake, one of the Great Salt Lake rooms. So
do you need staff support?
Our principle that we have been talking about, and I thought agreeing on, was that fund, the expenditures should be spent on lake benefits of whatever kind, however many people. And I think that was kind of our true north, and we should try to stick to that unless we want to discuss it again.
Well, the idea is that there'll be an opening discussion. There are some at their level, at the other two commissions level, who would like something this year to go to the legislature. I seriously doubt that's a real viable option. So the concept would be to let's discuss how this would be structured, and then we can bring it back to the entire council and show you what the concept is. I don't think the concept is bad, because right now for us to get funding for even a study like the integrated water model, we had to go, it took us 2 years going to the legislature to get the final funding. If the state had a pocket of $3 million a year coming out of the mineral lease, or two or four, whatever the number is, if they had that money coming out, then they could say, okay, this is now our priority, we'll fund that.
And that's what we have, a five-year strategic plan, so to speak. It's basically just a list of things we want to get done, plans we want to see done. You know, we do our plans every 5 to 10 years. You know, modeling work we want to be done, project work. And so what we're hoping is, if we got an ongoing appropriation, we could just, you know, take the top few chunks off of that every year. And the reality is, the sovereign lands restricted account, it funds the division. It funds, you know, your firefighter. It funds a lot of things. And so I think, in my opinion, a portion of it, you are going to have to put it, the money, the sovereign lands account does go into other sovereign lands other than the Great Salt Lake, because it does make money on lands, not a lot, but on lands other than the Great Salt Lake.
Well, and the reality is, you're not going to get it all going back to the lake.
So even if
we could spend it, the reality is, under the current scenario, you'll never get that happening, because it's looked at as a pot of money available for the legislature. So if some of it comes back to the forestry fire, there's a greater potential it could go into lake-wide issues,
right,
as well as Jordan River, Utah Lake, Bear Lake, and all the rest. But it would be a prioritized basis, and we would then be able to work with the division on that. We'll bring that back after this gets some fleshing out of what it looks like. Go ahead, Lynn.
Do you ever see the advisory council in Brownies and Girl Scout terms, flying up to become a commission? I mean, is there anything on your dream radar to continue to pursue that as a possible goal? Or is the advisory...
We'll clarify what you mean by
the policy authority. Do you mean the policy authority versus advisory authority?
Well, I'm not funding, I'm formal. Yeah.
I can't imagine that would ever happen.
Well, it's not easy.
Commission, in the sense that there's funding put into it, would be
sure.
Like the Jordan River Commission or the Utah Lake Commission, but they don't have any policy authority. They're still advisory only in nature.
Yeah, I don't know as if it's a substance change to be a commission versus a council. The way the other ones are working, the Jordan River has very narrow, commission has very narrow corridor that they can pine on. You know, they can't go very far upstream either.
Well, but the commissions can issue, projects can run through the commission.
Right, so they can get money. They can get money. If they can get money, they can do a project.
And they're a pay to play, so every member that is there is contributing funding to be on the commission.
They have dedicated staff members.
Right, but if we got a dedicated staff person who was from Forestry Fire, who could then be utilized to help find grant money, it'd be the same thing with or without it being a commission.
Yep.
But the money would just be funneled through Forestry Fire.
Yep.
If I might offer a comment, Bill James from the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. I don't have a broad perspective outside of wildlife issues, but our advisory councils compared with our policy-making bodies, our boards, are pretty substantially different in that one can issue even administrative code. They can create, I don't know the lawyer's term for that, but something that's enforceable, and our advisory councils clearly cannot. So it makes a pretty large difference.
It is, except the commissions don't have the ability to issue those regulatory enforcements either, both the Utah League and the Bird River. So the if we're talking about a board structure that is a setting rules and regulations, that's different from a commission or from the council. So they don't have that, and we won't probably ever get that.
I was just thinking back to the first Great Salt Lake Advisory Council and our recommendation for a commission.
Anything's possible. Commissioner Ferry's no longer, I mean, Representative Ferry's no longer there.
You never know. Don't stop dreaming.
Well, I think we do a pretty good job of managing the lake.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure what a commission, if it's advisory, it doesn't, I don't know that it would interact any differently than we're doing right now. If we had the title commission versus council, I'm not sure I see that as being any different.
So we have a few subjects that we're talking about doing. That was brought up. There's the three that we talked about is air quality issues, Utah Tasting Training Range, at low lake level review of the CMP, and we will bring back this fourth one, which is this concept of a funding mechanism through Forestry Fire.
My suggestion was broader than that, though, that just that you look at coordinating with the Jordan River Commission, Utah Lake Commission, since these water bodies are connected and beyond just the funding part. You don't have to, but I think they agreed they were going to try once a year to meet together, mm-hmm. and I don't see why this group wouldn't be part of that joint meeting.
Sure.
But one more. We should, I think, since we're advisory, we should ask the agencies if they have anything they would like to put on our agenda.
I have a whole presentation.
Yeah. It's kind of a boomerang for them. Yeah. They ask for something, they get it back.
Joe?
Every year, it's right as spring, the Utah Water Users Association, Rudy Julander, gives his update on the snowpack, and it provides Utah water users an indication as to what kind of year. It usually gets me stressed out to start the year out, but I think it's really relevant to planning on the lake. You know, what do we expect the snowpack to do?
And he's highly entertaining.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he is a well-attended talk every year at the Water Users Association.
Okay. If we're done with that for the moment, if anybody, unless someone has something else they'd like to bring up, and I've got about five or six items here now. We'd like to, if everybody's got the time, we'd like to turn about 10 minutes or so over to Jody. Last year, Don and I went to the Water Quality Board to request funding for some of the water quality studies that we felt needed to be accomplished on the lake. That funding was provided, and the division is beginning to get involved. I think this year you're going to start those studies, right? So Jody's going to give us an update on where they're at in terms of the Great Salt Lake Management Strategy, which includes the research necessary to come about and move forward water quality-related issues for the lake. So, Jody?
All right, Leland. I thought we were out of time, but here I am.
No, no, we want to get this.
I think it's better if I sit
twice.
Than stand. I think you can see me better, so I hope you're not. Let's just give this a second.
Can you fill some lines?
There we go. I'll make this real brief. In 2012, we went to all the stakeholders and the Water Quality Board, and we introduced a Great Salt Lake Water Quality Strategy. And what that was designed to do is to plan to protect the water quality of the aquatic and recreational beneficial uses. And we had to do two major things. We had to develop numeric criteria. We had no numeric criteria on Great Salt Lake. And we needed strategic monitoring research. And so we put that plan out there, and we got 200 substantive comments. It took a couple of years for us to respond, in addition to us doing some interim measures that I'll report on in a second. We went to the Water Quality Board with our response to comments, and in response, we changed the five core components. But really, they're more direct. We were developing numeric criteria, but numeric criteria are very different for ones that are designed to protect your health as opposed to protect a bird. And so the pollutant concentrations are different. And so we decided to create three more components. We have an aquatic life use, numeric criteria development, we have recreation use, and the nutrient assessment plan, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. So we have strategic monitoring research and wetlands. And what we did is we tied in public communication and involvement into each core component. So that was a big difference. And so I'm just going to go through some of the strategy implementation activities and mention a couple of other studies that we're doing. I'm going to mention this one first. Let me do this. The nutrients and cytotoxin data synthesis, that's new. But it's based off of two studies, like I said earlier, that Central Davis Sewer District, Division of Water Quality, and some other funders. One was Utah State University. There's a graduate student who did a significant amount of transects on Farmington Bay. So they had 10 going all the way down like that, collecting nutrients, cytotoxins, and metals. And we also, Leland was funding Brad Martin to do a significant study that's ongoing. The graduate study was a one-time only. But this is the Brad Martin study is ongoing, and they're doing the same transects. But the interesting thing is they're finding similar levels of cytotoxins and nutrients. However, they use different methods, and so this is a really good opportunity for us to synthesize that data. In addition to the other studies that Erica mentioned, the paleolimnological study that just got peer reviewed. And this Willard Spur work research that I'll talk about in a second. So we're very excited about that. I'm going to go through each of these. This is, I don't have the sound, but this is a video of Ryan Rowland from USGS collecting water quality data from Gilbert Bay. And this is to illustrate how difficult this is and what unique techniques we have to use. We have to use... So you're on the boat, it's usually very windy, and it's going up and down. You've got this pump right here, it pumps out of the water, goes in the chamber, and the reason why you have to use the chamber, and you also use double gloves, is because you'll contaminate the sample, so it's to eliminate contamination. And you have to do that at every depth and at every side. And so this is a three-day event. And that's just on Gilbert Bay. On Gunnison Bay, it's even more extreme because it's so salty that when you put your equipment in, it just comes out with just salt all over it. And so it fouls your equipment. And because of this, we couldn't just do what we do around the rest of the state. We had to have a special plan for Great Salt Lake and had to have special quality assurance, quality control measures. And that took a long time to develop, and it took a long time to get the partners because we need people with boats, we need people with the equipment. So we put together this baseline sampling plan. We started in 2010. We had to implement in 2011, 2012. We couldn't sample in 2013 because of procurement problems, which I'll talk about in a second. But we did assess the data in our integrator report, which we plan to do. It's our report to Congress on the state of Utah's waters, and has a whole appendix on, or now chapter, on Great Salt Lake. So you can see the results of that. But I do want you to notice that on Farmington Bay, we only have two sites, because that's all we have the resources for. We want to add sites in Gunnison Bay, additional sites in Farmington Bay. We only have one in Bear River Bay right now. So we're going to take advantage of that 2013 Farmington Bay data and synthesize that for our integrated report. Okay, so the advisory council went to the Water Quality Board and requested funding for these two studies. Thank you so much. It's a laboratory round robin. What that is you take a sample of salt water and you spike it with the pollutant, and then you send it out to all these labs and you get the results. And you see how close they came to the true value, the accuracy, or how close they came to each other. Is it precise? Is it representative? So we were very excited about that. We started the RFP process in July. It's January. Why did it take so long? Well, there's a couple of reasons. One, the RFP process takes forever. But the other problem was that when we take that salt water, and we're taking it at the same concentration in Gilbert Bay, around 12%, with the same ion composition, every time we make it in the lab, and it has to be the same, it precipitates. It forms salt because it's so salty. So we're having a lot of difficulty with that, but we can't go on to the next study, nor can we go any of our sampling that we do in the summer. We don't have a lab until we finish this, so it's critical that we get the laboratory round robin done, and we'll have it done by March if the precipitate problems almost solved. But anyway, these are the laboratories that are participating in that round robin. We took the results from 2011-2012 and we put it through sort of a rigorous analysis comparing the pollutant levels to EPA's freshwater and saltwater numerical water, criteria. We also looked to see if those known pollutants were in discharges, because we had to prioritize. We can't look at every single pollutant. We want to know what pollutants are most dangerous in Great Salt Lake, and this was the list. We're going to look at arsenic, copper, methylmercury, and lead. We defer these for now because of resources, but that's what we're going to use for our tox testing. And toxicological testing is necessary to develop numeric criteria, but all that is you culture brightshrimp and brine flies, meaning you grow them from infancy to adult. And you put them in a tank, and it's sort of sad because you're dosing them until they die. And so you have this no effect concentration where, you know, you can have a little bit of pollutant, but it's diluted and there's no effect to lethal effect. And that's what acute toxicity testing is. Short-term exposure, what is the lethal effect? It took a year and a half to work out the methods with EPA, because they have methods to develop the numeric criteria for our freshwaters, like our lakes and our rivers. But the methods for Great Salt Lake are totally different. You have a different, you have these different organisms, and the EPA level, the federal level, they don't feed their organisms because they don't have to, the ones that are most sensitive to these toxins for like a freshwater. But for Great Salt Lake, the brine shrimp will die, and then you didn't know if they died from the pollutant or if they died from not eating. And so we worked out all these things, but it took a year. It's not trivial. This is, okay, I'm going on. Per the strategy, we knew the strategy was going to take a certain amount of time. Meanwhile, we're issuing discharge permits to direct dischargers for Great Salt Lake and indirect dischargers to Jordan River and others. And we needed a process, an interim permitting process for Great Salt Lake dischargers and their permits. And just so you know that we put this in place, it's been public notice, it's been vetted by the permittees, and we're just we're almost through an entire round of permittees. We have a couple more that are direct discharge of Great Salt Lake, but basically they're based on a screening to see, okay, are there any pollutants that we should pay attention to? And then after that, they look into different methods for wet testing. Willard Spur. Now, Willard Spur wasn't part of the strategy, but we'll incorporate it into the Great Salt Lake wetlands component. But we had a wastewater treatment facility come in here, but we really didn't know what the effect would be to this ecologically important critical area. And it was that permit was challenged. It wasn't appealed, it was challenged. And so we needed the research necessary to know what nutrient concentrations could come out of that wastewater treatment facility. And there was two important things that came out of this research. One, in the spring, the water's clear. And there's a lot of good bird food growing. And it gets tons of pelicans. And so the spring, pelicans are eating fish, and everything's great. And then what happens is all that vegetation dies, nutrients accumulate, you have a lot of algae, and then you have different birds that like that ecosystem. And then every year it all flushes out. And so there's not, they found that the assimilative capacity, meaning the plants uptake the nutrients, that we really don't have a nutrient problem from the wastewater treatment facility. However, it highlighted the fact that we need water, and that water comes from the Bear River, and the Bear River Migratory Bird Refuge is going to work to put that into their management plan, but it highlights that maybe diversions upstream could have downstream effects. We're working on narrative criteria for this very ecologically important area. Wetlands. We get wetland program development grants from the EPA, and what we do with that money is build tools so that we can assess, are they in good condition, are they in fair condition or poor condition, so that we can prioritize. Right now we're mapping with that money, and we're developing kind of indicator tools. Next we'll look at the stresses on the wetlands, and this is all being done by our wetland coordinator. The paleo study was, they took soil cores, and Leland talked about this at an early meeting, but you can look back at to what was part of the lake, what was deposited in the lake sediments from hundreds and hundreds of years, or even pre...
Well, we're going back to
1800, which is, and there was even cyst, still viable cyst, those bunch eggs in the soil cores, which I thought was really cool. We had that peer review because there were some issues with the study, and it's been sort of resolved. We know what we can use from the study and what we can't, and that's the Gilbert Bay core, apparently. So what's next? We'll complete Lab Rava. We're going to have a species workshop, and in order to develop new MARE criteria, you have to know what species you have in each of these bays, and then you have to know what are the requirements, salinity, temperature, and then which is the most sensitive, because that's the one that's going to become the most important for each bay for numeric criteria development. So that's in March, and I encourage anybody who would like to contribute to attend that. We're going to monitor, we're going to do acute tox testing, we're going to do the farm to bay data synthesis, we're a part of the integrated water resource model, and we're going to develop these core components. I have to say this is a lot dependent on when we get this coordinator on board, but the round robin, the tox testing, the species workshop, that's being done by our specialists in the division. But hopefully all this other stuff will get done too. The monitoring for sure. All right, that's it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot going on with the
Division 1 economy. Anybody else have something they'd like to bring forward before we adjourn the meeting?
If move not, to adjourn.
We'll take a motion to adjourn. Thank you.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm
this is a lot of fun.
Oh my God! I was thinking that if I did it by March, then we have a lot of knowledge on the
Pull them off, what's the cost? Just raise it everywhere, all the time.
But we don't
put them in, it's not a good area. Yes, indeed.
Everybody goes in.
Well, I think now there's something to the small.